Good morning. My name is Mike Andrews. I am the campus minister with the Christian Student Fellowship over at Penn State Altoona, and I'm also on staff here at First Church. John's on vacation. I actually just talked to him a couple minutes ago. He's currently sitting in an airport in Puerto Rico while I'm sitting up here doing his job. But he asked me if I would be able to cover for him today and preach, and I was like, yeah, sure, I guess. You know, I don't think I have a contract with this church, but, you know, I'll do it because I enjoy preaching. And, of course, I do it with a glad heart because I love to actually preach. But today we're looking at Jude verses 5 through 13. We're continuing the series that we've been doing on Jude. And so what Jude has to say here is this. Now, I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah, the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example by undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Yet in like manner, these people also, relying on their dreams, defile the flesh, reject authority, and blaspheme the glorious ones. But when the archangel Michael, contending with the devil, was disputing about the body of Moses, he did not presume to pronounce a blasphemous statement, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." But these people blaspheme all that they do not understand, and they are destroyed by all that they, like unreasoning animals, understand instinctively. Woe to them. For they walked in the way of Cain and abandoned themselves for the sake of gain to Balaam's error and perished in Korah's rebellion. These are hidden reefs at your love feasts, as they feast with you without fear. Shepherds feeding themselves, waterless clouds swept along by winds, fruitless trees in late autumn, twice dead, uprooted. Wild waves at sea, casting up the foam of their own shame. Wandering stars, for whom the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved forever. When I read this, and when John asked me to preach it, you know, I read through it multiple times, just to get an understanding of what's going on there. And what I see first off is Jude saying, hey, listen up, I want to remind you of something. And then he goes into using multiple examples to help us understand what he's trying to remind us of. If we look at verses 6, 7, and 11, we see the examples that Jude uses. And there's some Jewish history, some Old Testament backstory there that helps us understand even more what he's talking about. In verses 6 and 7, he first talks about Israel and their exodus and wandering. Israel being delivered by the hand of God out of Egypt into the promised land. But then they had to wander for 40 years because when they came out, first they worshipped an idol while Moses was up Mount Sinai. But God forgave them of that. But then as they continued on, they got to a point where they go, I want to stay in this land. Not the land that you promised us. Not the land that you want to give us. I want to stay here. I think this is going to be okay compared to the greatness that you can give us because I don't really think you can make us get in there and get us through it all. And because of that, God had them wander in the wilderness for 40 years to kill off an entire generation of mistrustful Israelites. Jude also talks about angels being cast out of heaven. This is more of a traditional mythological idea that came up in Jewish culture, and we as Christians believe this as well. Somewhat, some of us do. But that's an entirely different topic. But these angels, there's the mythology, the belief, the historical idea that Lucifer rose up against God and brought up a third of the angels with him to replace God. And of course, whenever you go up against God, you always lose because God always has to win. And when they did that, when God won, he cast them out of heaven into hell. And then Jude talks about Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities. These cities which reveled in sexual immorality and perversions, of which they would not repent, and for which God destroyed. And then looking at verse 11, We have Cain, who murdered his brother out of envy Cain, who murdered his brother out of envy for the pleasure of God. God looked on Abel with pleasure, with compassion, with happiness because of his sacrifice. Cain, out of envy of that, murdered his brother. Balaam, who, while not an Israelite himself, but a prophet of God, who understood God the Most High, who worshiped and who prophesied for God, Yahweh, the God that we believe in, attempted to curse the Israelites for monetary gain. And then Korah, who was a man who was a part of the Exodus that came out of the land of Egypt, delivered by God himself under Moses and Aaron, of the tribe of Levi, a Levite priest, someone who was to be a good steward of God's congregation and God's temple and God's tabernacle, who didn't trust God and his leaders. And so he rose up and brought others up with him to rebel against Moses and Aaron. And then in verse 8, Jude says what they did. Sodom and Gomorrah and Cain defiled the flesh through sexual immorality and murder. The angels in Korah rejected authority, wanting to replace God, wanting to lead, wanting that power. And then Israel and Balaam blasphemed. Israel, having seen the actions of God and understanding the promises of God and his power to come through on those, and still rejecting those promises, wanting something less instead of the greater that God promised. Not trusting that God would come through, and Balaam attempting to curse God's people for monetary gain. So why did they do all of this? Jude writes in verse 8 that they were relying on their own dreams. Dreams here doesn't mean like the dreams that we have when we're sleeping or when we're sitting at work or at school not wanting to do anything, so we're, you know, dreaming about driving the 69 Chevelle, you know, up 99, doing 110 miles an hour because, you know, that's my dream. But not that kind of dream. But the ambitions, goals, hopes, the one day I'll do this. And these dreams and these goals, in this particular usage, means those which are opposite of God's kingdom. And still expecting him to fulfill those dreams. All of these actions, rejecting authority, sexual immorality, blasphemy, all of these were done out of hopes, dreams, ambitions, which were opposite of God's kingdom. In all of these examples, what I see is multiple people desiring a lesser good in replacement of the greater good that God promises us. So with all of that, what is it that Jude's trying to remind us of? What is it that Jude really, really wants us to know, to remember, to take away? And we see this at the end of the passage. He sees that these people, like these examples, are all around us. And he wants us to keep an eye out for people that are going to lead us astray. To watch out for those that breed mistrust in God. And to be aware of a rebellious heart and others. In the words of Mad-Eye Moody from Harry Potter, Jude is saying constant vigilance. Constantly be on your toes. Constantly be on the lookout for those around you that are leading others astray. With all of this, I see a connection to 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10. And I promise we're not going to go through all three chapters. I don't have time for that. But Jude says and reminds us and tells us about these people that are around us can lead us astray. Paul writes about how we need to be weary of our audience because we don't know who's watching. And we could lead others astray with our actions. Jude gives examples of people that I think made small concessions and compromises to their character. And those small concessions and compromises led them away from God. And as they were led further and further away from God, they brought others with them. And Paul talks about these people that have this new freedom in Jesus, and they begin to exercise this freedom. But as they exercise this freedom, they have no thoughts of others. They have no thoughts of the consequences of their actions. They have no thoughts of what they can do to others around them. Both types of people do sinful acts. Both lead others astray. They make other people stumble. Some people do it on purpose. And they do it with this idea that they know better. They know better than God. They don't trust God. They think, God, I know you want this, but I think this is better. And so I'm going to do this instead. Because I think this is going to be better for the people than what you have in mind. In May, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is coming out, which I'm really excited for. I'm super nerdy. Jesus still loves me. I accept it. But recently a trailer came out, and there's a clip in it with Rocket the Raccoon talking to baby Groot. Groot about, you know, yay tall. And they're talking about this bomb and this trigger that Rocket put together. And Rocket's like, all right, listen, you see this trigger here? You see this button? Don't touch this button. You touch this button, you kill everyone, all right? Now, repeat it back to me. And Groot goes, I am Groot, and points to the button. And Rocket goes, no, don't touch that button. Do you want to kill everyone? What's wrong with you? What are you thinking? And this banner goes back and forth for a little bit. And so Rocket turns around and starts talking to someone else, and Groot picks up the trigger and runs away screaming, I am Groot. And then Rocket turns around and goes, well, that's not good. I don't know what's going to happen. The movie hasn't come out yet. How am I supposed to know? But what I see there is this idea of Groot thinking, okay, you know everything about this, and there's a chance this could go off if someone presses this button, so what if I just pick it up and run away with it and then just remove the temptation? And so Groot, possibly thinking he knows better than Rocket, is running away with this when he could very easily trip and fall running down the little tunnel he's going in and accidentally press the button. Or drop it and the button could be pressed and then everybody dies. I think other people can lead those around them astray without knowing. These people being too focused on their own freedoms and rights that they have, not worrying about those around them. In the original Jurassic Park, there's a scene where all the people are together having lunch, and Ian Malcolm says this, don't you see the danger inherent in what you're doing here? I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You read what others have done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourself, so you don't take any responsibility for it. The consequences are not your fault, is what he's saying. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, that they didn't stop to think if they should. I think this is a perfect example of a conversation that happens with us all the time. I think I can do this, so I'm just going to, without thought of if we should or not. Now, obviously, with all my references to movies so far, and as I said before, I am super nerdy and God still loves me, so I just accept it. But there's a favorite movie of mine, favorite series of movies, Star Wars. I love Star Wars, grew up watching Star Wars, love Star Wars, best movie ever, best set of movies ever. And I think it has a really, really good display of someone that does something for the good of others, but it leads to disastrous results. They have these good intentions, and so they perform these actions, but in performing these actions, they only show their immaturity and their lack of knowledge and wisdom. The example that I'm thinking of is the fall of Anakin Skywalker and rise of Darth Vader. Anakin was this Jedi, grew up in the Jedi Temple, grew up understanding the Jedi Code, part of which means he's not supposed to marry. Of course, which he does anyway and gets married to a woman. And Anakin, being so powerful in the Force, begins to have these dreams, these premonitions about the death of his wife and childbirth. And so he goes to one of the Jedi Masters, and he sits down, and he says, I'm having these premonitions about death. What am I supposed to do? And the Master gives him a very Jedi answer of rejoice for them for joining the Force. Don't mourn them, because through the Force, we'll see them on the other side. To which Anakin says, I'm not going to let this happen. I'm not going to lose her. And so he goes and he finds a new mentor. He goes and finds a new master, a Sith, to train under, who promises him, I'll teach you how to save your wife. We'll figure this out, I promise. And so in the hope of saving his wife, who he loves very, very much, Anakin begins to do all these different actions, which just lead him further and further away from the light. Ultimately, he ends up being the cause of his wife's death. Starting off with the intention to save her, he ends up being the cause of her death. I had a student recently who was 21 years old, knew his tolerance for alcohol, was well over 21, so legally he was able to drink, and occasionally enjoyed a beer. And him and I are talking about this one day, and he's like, I have a right to do this, I think. And I go, yeah, I think you do as well. And then the conversation turned to him going with plans on going to a tailgate party up at State College and possibly enjoying a few beers, as he says is his right. And so I remind him of this time where we went up to go work concessions at a Penn State game. And we park, we're walking through all the tailgaters to the stadium, me, him, and a couple other students, and we hear someone go, hey, CSF people. So we all stop and we wait, and this student walks up that we met earlier in the year at the activities fair. And we stand there, we talk with him, he goes, hey, I remember you guys, you know, we met at the activities fair, we talked a bit, you know, you guys seemed really cool, how's it going? We just stood there and chatted with him for a little bit. And then he went back his way, and we went back up ours. And after I reminded my student of this time, he didn't get the point that I was trying to make. So I asked him, how many students do you have interactions with where you let them know that you are a part of a Christian group called the Christian Student Fellowship? Quite a few, he said. How many do you think go up to state and party and tailgate before a game? Probably the majority of them. Now, what if someone there who grew up in a conservative area, rural area, in a conservative church or a conservative family, which is very possible in this area, what if someone who grew up like that saw you there enjoying your right to have a beer or two before a game? What would that do to your witness to them? I don't know, he said. And so I tell him this. While you have this right, you exercising that right can cause these people to stumble. If they know that you're a Christian and they have this mentality of this is what Christians are supposed to do, then you exercising your right is pushing them away because you've never had that conversation with them to know where they are at. You never know who's watching. So you, by exercising your freedom, is damaging your witness. And then I tell them something I tell the majority of my students, if not all. Just because you can, doesn't mean you should. Paul says the exact same thing in 1 Corinthians 10:23, of which he says, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. You see, I think we have an obligation to everyone around us. Those around us at school, those around us at home, those around us at work, in the grocery store, even here in this building, we have an obligation. That obligation is to be aware of what we do and who we reflect. When I was in high school, I'd go over to my youth minister's house and we'd hang out, play Guitar Hero, watch movies, you know, just do whatever, group of us high school students. And then I'd get up to leave because I'd get a text or a phone call from some friends, and I would go hang out with them. And every time I did, his wife would come up to me, about yay tall, poke me in the chest, and say, remember whose you are. Not who you are, whose. Who claims ownership to you? Who do you say that you are? Who do you say that you are a servant to? Who do you say has ownership over you? And that's always stuck with me. This idea that I'm not just my parents' kid. I'm not just a high school student. I'm not just a member of this church. Everywhere I go, no matter what I do, I am a servant of the Most High God, and I am reflecting him in all that I do, good or bad. Everything that I do is a testimony to his character as well. And I think we need to understand that we are servants, nothing more, and that we are fighting, contending, defending this faith that we say we have. And I don't think that we're just fighting against flesh and blood, against rulers and authorities, or the powers of darkness of this world, which Paul talks about in Ephesians. But I also think that we're fighting against ourselves. So C.S. Lewis writes about how salvation works. And first off, he says, we can never truly understand salvation because it's something that comes from God. Therefore, it's inexplainable. But we can use analogies to understand this. One of the analogies that C.S. Lewis uses is that of paying off someone's debt. Imagine someone comes up to you and says your mortgage, your car payments, your student loans, your credit cards, and any money that you owe somebody else is gone. I've taken care of it. Here's an extra million on top of that. By the end of this year, my wife and I are going to be $100,000 in debt because of student loans. If someone came up to me and said that $100,000 that you owe the government, don't worry about it, taken care of. Here's an extra million on top. I would have a heart attack and die out of my excitement for that. And then my wife could get my life insurance money on top of that. So, lucky her. But this idea of someone coming up and paying off our debt is exactly what Lewis talks about. And there's a theological term kind of tied to this, which is the ransom atonement theory. Atonement simply being it's been taken care of. Whatever it is has been taken care of, you have been atoned for. And this idea of the ransom atonement theory is that we are held ransom by something or someone. Something has taken us hostage. And Christ paid the amount asked for and then more. So who is it that's holding us ransom? I think it's ourselves. I think that we have trust issues with God. And we have control issues, and we want to be in control. And we don't always think that God has our best intentions at heart because we can't see the end. We don't know what's coming. The road ahead looks difficult. And so because of that, we take control of ourselves. We take ourselves hostage and hold ourselves against God and try to be in control because we think we know better. Jude tells us exactly what happens to these types of people. Phrases like punishment of eternal fire and gloom of eternal darkness are used for those that lead God's people astray. But thanks be to God who gave us his only son so that we can have eternal life. Who died at the absolute perfect time so that we can be justified and stand before God. Not as enemies or as rebels, but as friends, those who are at peace with God now. So what I want to leave you with is this. Like Jude, I want to remind you to watch out for those that will lead you astray. Watch out for the mistrust and rebellion in your own heart. Be aware of the effects that your exercising your freedoms can have on those around you. And above all else, I want you to remember the peace that you now have with God through his Son. Will you pray with me? Father God, we want to thank you today for all the blessings that you give us. We thank you for your Son. We thank you for this peace that we have. And I ask that you be with us as we go throughout this week and the rest of our lives, and let us keep an eye out for that rebellious heart that we can have and the rebellious hearts in others which lead us astray. We ask all these things in your Son's name. Amen.